No, you mean that, that's Alan, to make it pronounceable. And this is a kind of aspirant, the letter H. Only it is called a privative one. It's gentle. There are two ways of using this letter. One is, in the ancient form, we'd write one up, side down, and one right way up. And this one we call the spiritus asperis, the asperity. If you talk roughly to people to frighten them, that's called the spiritus asperis. This one is the spiritus asperis, which means the asperity breathing, when you intend to frighten somebody into behaving properly. That is when they're frightenable. And the upside down one, the spiritus lenis, the weak spirit, where you have to charm them if they're too big to hit. Those are the two spirits. And this letter A is used for both. In Greek, we would use the letter A like that, and a comma. If we put the comma that way, it would be the spiritus asper, and if we put the comma that way, it would be spiritus lenis, weak spirit. So, in the case of a word like the word asocial, or asocial, which means not social, really it's called a privative letter A. It deprives the word of its significance. So in the word amoral, it means not moral. But it isn't quite the same thing as unmoral or immoral. We say that the person is immoral who breaks a moral rule that he believes should be observed. But we call a man amoral, amoral, if he doesn't believe that morality has any validity at all. So there's a considerable difference between immoral and amoral. So if we wrote in the Greek form, if we wrote this, the comma that way, that would be spiritus lenis, and it would mean not. In the case of art moral, it would mean not moral. And if we wrote it in this way, and turned it that way, we would have to pronounce it like an H. We would say then ha. And this ha means power. Notice in the army when they're training officers to shout at the men, they teach them to throw ha up in the nose and say hum, which is the word for attention. Remember? Saying hum. Now, this form here is really in this word to be understood as both forms to be used alternately. So this is the same thing as the letter H. There are two forms of the H, gentle and hard. In the Old Testament, Abraham is the lenis or gentle spirit, and Isaac is the hard spirit. Now, this M means substance, and this N means noose. So if we draw the three parts of a man like this, we put M down there, N there, and R in the middle. R men. Now, the reason it goes in this order is because, first of all, there is energy, and that energy makes matter, and then entering into that matter formulates it as idea. Notice this is the word man as well. So the amen means the Trinity, the gathering together of your substance, your center of energy feeling, and your nous, or nous, your intelligence. So a man has three parts. In the case of an ordinary human being, his parts are arranged like that with a spine to connect them. And I've brought a pair of compasses tonight to show you. I hope this board will work. That the original form of it is done by inscribing a circle. This is the way it is actually done in the universe, where the dot in the middle is like a pebble striking the surface of the water, and this line is like a ripple moving away from it. Now, if we don't alter the pitch in the compasses and we just shift the center to the perimeter and draw another one in this manner. I thought that would happen on this board.
Yes, it's hard enough.
And thus, to fit exactly the perimeter of the one serving as centre to the other, we then take the centre of this one, the intersection point, and we then have the amen drawn. And you'll find that that is a very early representation of God, in which we will take the R here, and we'll take the M there, and the N there. And we'll see a very peculiar thing. When we say that this R is the middle part of a man, that is the part you feel with. Feeling, ideation, or thinking, and M for more, appetite, more. That is the conation or drive center. So here we have a feeling, here we have an idea, and here we have an appetite or urge. We call it more to keep the old fashioned symbology. More is a very archaic word meaning appetite, drive. This shows you that before a human being is made, in this stretched form, stretched on the rack of time, his eternal form is a trinity, like this. And you can then see the possibility of a relation. There's a relation in here where these two overlap. Here we have feeling and urge, those two. Here we have feeling and idea. And here we have urge and idea. So we have three possibilities of lapping these forms. This means that we can find in our consciousness that we are actually able to think, that is, have an idea about a feeling. We can have an idea about an urge, we can have a feeling about an urge, and we can have a feeling about an idea. So there is a link factor possible between the three parts of the being. And in the middle part here, which is the Garden of Eden, the central hidden part, these three are not divided, so that in the middle we can say is the amen, the feeling, the drive, and the idea in the center of the being. This diagram, by simply stretching it, pulling this circle out and up, we draw one circle here, this is the M, here is the other one touching through its center. And we deliberately dislocate this one and pull it right to the top and leave a little space and put the spine on. All we've done is remove the ideation center from here and push it to the top. And we then have the temporal man, the man in time. And we will see why it is necessary for a man to be dislocated in this way. You see that here these two overlap and produce the rib cage, and then the pelvis here, with your legs hanging down. There's your rib cage, and here's your pelvis. Down there is the more or appetite center. Here is your feeling center, and here's your idea center. They're separated out in this manner in time, so that you can learn to coordinate those things which originally were simultaneous. When they were simultaneous in the state called Edenic, where Eden means actually don't judge, the state of non-judgment. This Den is Dan, judgment. The tribe of Dan in the Bible means judgment. This E here should be an A of a privative order. This one means don't judge. So in the state of innocence of Adam in the middle, or of the cosmic substance, there is no difference between feeling, thinking, and urging. But because of the simultaneity of it, it was difficult to control it. And therefore, in the Genesis story, it says that God saw that it was not good for man to be alone. Alone is all one. You see, they've just left out one of the letter L. Alone is the same as all one. And if you are not all one, you cannot be alone. The person who can be happy on his own is a unified person. So that the concept of aloneness, the statement by Plotinus, the flight of the alone to the alone, that is, at the centre of the soul of a man, back to the absolute, is the statement about integration of the three parts, which recreate the essential unity of the man. So, in the time process, man has the ideation pulled out and lifted up on this spinal stick, so that thinking processes occur separately in the head, without emotional contagion necessarily taking place, and he can feel without the thinking necessarily conditioning it, and also he can urge without feeling much about it. So the whole process of the unific being there is severed or dislocated in the temporal man. So the great Amen means the original centre before the dislocation of these three parts, and when the parts are dislocated, that is the beginning of the time process for each person. And from that moment, the moment the child enters time, then begins the separation of thinking, feeling and urging, so that we can actually experience in our own being the fact that we're able to think without feeling. We don't have to think when we hear the word cruelty. We don't have to feel cruelty. We can just say cruelty and leave it at that as a thought. Likewise, if we feel cruel, it does not follow that we are thinking cruelly at that moment. We might not have the word cruelty in our mind, and yet we may feel cruel, and we may hide the thought process that supports the feeling of cruelty in the process we call repression psychologically, so that we can feel cruel and yet deny in the thinking process that we are being so. And likewise, the urge centre may go on doing things even though you feel that they're bad for you, because the urge centre can go on eating dinner long after you're feeling fed up yourself, and long after your reason has said enough. There's a little thing that is sometimes done experimentally in biology of just cutting a little nerve here in some animals, and then the stomach goes on eating until it bursts. It does not stop. So that the fact that that nerve, when cut, allows the stomach to eat till it bursts, shows that this nerve, which we cut, is really having a control effect on the appetite. Which, if that control were absent in everybody, the stomach would always eat whatever was available, and thus burst itself and perish. So we see here these three wheels which are dislocated, and particularly the thinking one, man means to think, particularly the thinking wheel, which is dislocated and elevated and held away from the others, can be kept away from the others in order that they do not interfere with it. Because you can see that the urge centre and the feeling centre are very much more closely linked. Now, if we compare that with the form of the head of a wasp, its thorax, and then its abdomen, we find it has a very, very thin waist. And if we take the form of the head of an ant, and its thorax, and its waist, we find it tremendously thin. So in the case of the man, there's a very close relation between his feeling and his urge. In the case of these insects, these departments work quite independently. And you know, in the case of the insects, the six legs come always out of the thorax, not out of the abdomen. And if we take an ant called a warrior ant, which has big jaws and fights, it is actually possible, and is experimentally done, to cut off with a pair of forceps the abdomen without the ant stopping to fight. The ant will go on fighting although its abdomen has been nipped off, which shows that the mechanism of thought to do with the preservation of the ant colony is recorded not in this department but up here in this ideational department, out of which the weapons grow, the horns. stored the aggression. Now, one ancient tradition says that the mind is the organ of fear, because if we were omnipotent, we wouldn't need to think. If we were omnipotent, we would say, let there be the table laid. We wouldn't need to go and lay it. If we were omnipotent and somebody came to the door and said, you haven't paid your income tax, we'd say, let there be coinage and give him some. And if we were omnipotent, we would never be afraid. So that we think is a proof that we are not omnipotent, and that we are not omnipotent is a proof that we have need to be afraid. And fear, if allowed to express itself, begets aggression. And therefore, the aggression mechanism tends to spring out of the intellectual centre. The legs which carry you to and from things spring out of the emotional centre. Yeah. And this part just breaks down the matter, the food, to supply you with drive power. So we see a slight difference in the form of the man and the insects. And yet they're essentially three-part beings. But in these two, the abdomen and the thorax are separated to show you that they work instinctually. And they haven't got the possibility of coordination reflexively like a man has. Their form is fixed. Whereas in the case of a man with this spinal column, with its coordinating nerves going through the centres, and with the fact that the brain is kept free from the feeling and the urge, there is a great possibility of man learning to integrate himself and thus release himself from the mechanical processes which completely determine the behaviour of the bees and the ants and the wasps. We know that the bee and the ant and the wasp have perfect social systems in which there is absolutely no individual freedom whatever. And we know that the general left-wing theory, the socialist moving towards the communist, has an idea that the state could establish something like a beehive in which every human being would work. But there's something in humanity that doesn't like the idea of being reduced to the level of a mere cog in the social machinery. This something in man is really the memory of this condition he had when he was not a member of a state, a mere cog, but a free being who has been flung into the time process to learn how to regain his freedom so that he can never again lose it. As he becomes aware of these three parts and is able to separate them out consciously, so that thinking for him is thinking, not spoiled by emotion, and the feeling life is not spoiled by this urge underneath it, when he can see these three things simultaneously and coordinate them on this rod of office, the spinal cord, then his integration work is done and he is free from any external pressures. He then becomes his own master. And that is a short outline of the significance of the Amen. And I'm going to show you one of the funny things that occurs in the tradition of the devil. You can see that this center triangle gives us the possibility of integrating the three aspects of our being. And you can also see that we struck this circle and this one on the intersections of the other two. So there must be a possibility of another circle with its centre there. I won't do it on that one, I'll give another one. Because I want to show you the meaning of the particular. Call that one, if you wanted to, God the Father. That is the chief, the head. Chief is kef, kep, cap, the head, capital. And on this side, we can do the Son. And on this side, we can do the ghost, or semblance. And we can see that if we wish to do so, there is another one here, and there's another one there, and another one there. And we can see that if we strike a circle from here, it will pass through that middle bit. If we strike a circle from here, it will pass through the middle bit. And if we strike a circle from here, it will pass through the middle bit. Now I'm going to draw one of these in just to show what happens. Now, the possibilities for any being are these. It must have form to begin with. The Greek word for form is idea. That form exists in a space which is a field, the field itself, and that is experienced as feeling. And it must have urge or drive, that is substance, that's the food that we eat. Now there are three necessities of any being. There must be a field force, there must be a substance, and there must be a form. Form in substance cannot itself change unless there is a force acting upon it to induce change. So if we take the form of a billiard ball, in which there is just form and neither in there, it cannot change. But if we introduce a new force into it, then it will split. So to produce changing of substance and form, we must have these three. But we don't want more than three, because if we have more than three, we'll be introducing another one of those again from another centre. So supposing we say, here is the original, there is the field, that's force, God the force, or God the Father generator. Here is the idea, and here is the urge or drive substance which you get from food. Now the coordination centre of that requires that there be nothing else in the middle there. You want one force, one controlling idea, the master concept, one substance unified in the middle. And remember that these are like impacts on centres in universal substance. And these are like overlapping ripples. You get these, if you throw a few stones on water, you will then see these ripples intersecting each other in just this pattern. If we allow that there is another impact from here, causing a ripple to go across here, this ripple centre must be like the one over there, force. So it must contest for the middle of the beam. In other words, you will have two forces in opposition in the body. And there will then be a fight between the two forces. And this fight could go on interminably, or one of them will gain the victory. And the one that gains the victory will so strengthen the vibrations of this circle in here that it completely pushes out, distorts, and gradually pushes out this one. So that eventually this triad is then under the dominion of this centre, and this one has been pushed down. Well, the one that wins defines the other one as the devil. But it isn't actually decided until the battle is finished which one is the devil. There are two forces at work. If we take the development of a child, there is first an egg, and then there appears, I won't draw the nucleus in to keep it simple, there appears a streak in it, which will become the spinal column, and one end of it becomes the head and the other end of it becomes the belly, and this head part develops until it occupies practically all of that, until you get this little thing stuffed out there, and then you have a baby with a very big head and a very tiny little body, and until it's got lots of food pushed into the body is very, very tiny. So that when babies are born, they have very big heads. The heads do not grow very much until they've taken in a lot of food. And then it is this lower circle that grows, the belly circle taking the food. But this streak here, which becomes the spinal cord, has a positive and a negative centre. And in the development of the egg, these two centres fight. Now, if you remember in the case of the cell division, we said there was a nuclear centre, and at that centre migrated, split in two, and part went up there and part went down there, and then they started vibrating and sending messages across each other until eventually they built a wall across there. That's actually what happens in the development of any animal egg in the process of splitting. So there is a south centre and there is a north centre in the being, and this will later form itself as the diaphragm, and here is your spinal axis. So it is always two centers fighting and producing a stress in the middle, the diaphragm, to which all the forces are being filtered. Forces from above are stopped by it, forces from below are stopped by it, so that there's any difference between the thinking center and the drive center from below. But one of these centers has to rule. If the man's brain rules, he defines this as the devil. But if this rules, he defines this as the devil. So when a man is under the dominion of the belly, he thinks that thinking is silly, because he's enjoying himself. And if a man becomes so dominated by the intellect that he paralyzes his activities below, he defines them as bad for him. He's not a whole being, so that the intellectual being is not really a whole being. He's merely a being in training who has been fighting the South Pole. Suppose we call that the South Pole sexuality and the North Pole nous, intelligence. Well, then these two things are fighting. This leads us into relationships and gets us into bondage and trouble and responsibility. This one doesn't like the responsibilities, so it tries to devise ways of escape. And ultimately one of them wins. If the South Pole wins, we call him a foolish fellow who's always in trouble. But he calls himself a man who is living his life. Whereas he thinks this fellow at the top is an intellectualist who's wasting his life. But the intellectualist thinks this fellow is wasting his life and is a substance. So I want you to understand that this question of good and evil is relative. The man at the belly level enjoying himself defines it as a good thing for him. The man in the intellect defines it as a good thing for him. But the real good is the integration center at Amen here, which allows you at will either to have a true idea, a feeling, or an appetite in their due proportions. So the whole man is the three circulating together, and a part of a man, like party politics, cannot possibly govern the country. We must have these three for every being, and they must be harmoniously related, to which end we must, at certain points of the scale, define one end or the other as an enemy for the time being. From the point of view of a newborn baby, he gets the urge from the belly, and a message is sent up through the gullet passage to the lips, producing the so-called oral phase of stimulation in Freudian terms. So if he wants to suck and gets pleasure from it, he wants to do that so he can expand his little belly and get it bigger and bigger and bigger until he becomes a big boy. And as he's stretching this, he then becomes full grown. It is his food bag, and he puts the food in his mouth, takes it down there, breaks it down, steals the energy from the food and brings it up again here to make thought, so that he can look through his eyes to see what else there is to do. It's essential to see that the whole man is three, that a man is a trinity. He has three parts. One is an idea. He must have a true idea. He must have the right feeling, the feeling for wholeness, which is universal compassion. And he must have the right kind of substance in him, the right kind of drive. He must take the right things into him to get the right kind of energy, to give him the right kind of drive. And when he's doing those three things at once, then he is not a man of bits, he's a whole man. And to be whole is the same as being holy. You see, if we take the word whole, you notice there's a word whole in it there. That is the whole in which those three circles are inscribed, and the holy man is simply the same fellow. Now this W here is two V's lapped on each other, which mean volition or power, and when they're integrated, it means a being. Because a being is an intersection of powers. So when we take a hole, there's a hole, I'll draw one, I'll use it to draw holes. There's a hole, and then we write inside it V and V, upside down. This is this Amen Spiritus Asper Lenis. This again is this whole being. And you can see already the Solomonic star coming back into it, which gives the balanced man. And this letter Y at the end means integration power. So a holy man is an integrated man, and an integrated man is a holy man. And in order to get that wholeness, you must integrate those three parts. In order to integrate them, you must understand what you've got. In order to understand what you've got, we've had to separate them out in time so that we can examine them separately. And then when we understand what thinking is, what feeling is, and what this drive substance is, then we can tie them all together and recreate this Edenic or non-divided state in the center of our being. That is a general outline of the Amen. Now, are there any particular questions you'd like to ask on this before we go any further?
Well, there is a significance in the very word itself. The A is there because of there is a reason for the A being A.
Yes. Well, A is the head of the alphabet, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, when it says I'm Alpha and Omega, that is A and they begin. You see? The O big, Omega, Omega means big, but it means substantially big. So if we were to write A, that's a triangle originally, and O, like this, or A, and O, that is Alpha and Omega, and it's a short way of drawing this. Instead of drawing that whole diagram, this is Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. Now the beginning is A, which means energy. The end of it is the O, full of substance. This is the great I Am. There's M inside there, you see. The great I Am, ideation, energy, substance. So that the letter A, which begins all the alphabetic languages, means the energy which is prior to creation, and which is itself the cause of creation. So that when it says the Alpha and the Omega, the Alpha means the energy, and the Omega is the big universe inside which everything is precipitated. Well, it's really the same word. You'll notice that in this Sanskrit Om, it is frequently written A-U-M in order to pronounce it. Now, it is pronounced from the back of the mouth to the front of the mouth through the middle of the mouth. And at the back of the mouth, you have a gullical sound. In the middle of the mouth, you have R. And on the lips, you have M. So really, at the back, you say O. Gullical, in the middle, ah, and on the lips, mm. But you shouldn't say it serially. It isn't ah, oo, mm. It's with the lips closed, mm. Because it is essential that the lips should remain closed, because that word symbolizes the whole of the big universe as a closed system. So when it is said that there is a secret pronunciation of this, the secret pronunciation of that is to keep your mouth closed. Or Masonically we say mum's the word. Mum's the word, we say. Mum's the word means this Om signifies all that is substantiated. And that is the same as the Omega of the Greeks. Now every man was inside the big universe. You remember we did a six-pointed star to represent the big universe. Then a man inside, and then a five-pointed star inside there to symbolize the five senses, and then a little circle inside for his consciousness of the universe. The one inside is the same as the one outside. And by means of the five sense organs, we are kept out of phase. If we had 6 points exposed to the 6 points of the universe, we would always obey it. It would be an entirely mechanical relation. We would hear the good and the true and the beautiful, and we would promptly do them because we'd have no method of avoiding it. But by having the five sense structure, we can put ourselves out of phase and thereby choose whether we will obey or not. So, in the meditation on Om, what has to be meditated is all this significance here. The Om contains these three. We could draw the circle around that and bind those together, and that is the Om.
When you spoke last week about the brothers that went from one country to another and they called one brother called one name God,
yes.
The other called it the devil, were they applying that principle?
Yes. This polarity principle. capacity, because if you don't divide, you cannot conquer. And when you have to deal with a lot of people, supposing you employed a lot of people, you know very well that people are invariably ambitious, and everybody would like to be the boss without his responsibility, if they could find such a job. And they are, in general, irrational, that is, they are not placed up here. They're generally placed fairly low down here. So the urge centres and the crossing over of the emotive centre is about the highest point. And there, they're always trying to get their own way, but they don't know how. They can see somebody up there that's got more authority and power, and they would like it, but they don't like the responsibility, so they won't work for it. But because they would like the power, they criticise it. And therefore, he has to devise a method of filtering what these beings down below, who would like to climb on each other, really mean when they report each other for naughtiness. The same thing goes on inside the individual body. When, if you're supposing you're sitting near the fire and it's warm, and you know it's cold outside, but there's nothing on the television, and you know there's a good show on in town, and if you could drag yourself out of a chair to go there through the cold air, you would get there. But there's something in you that doesn't want to be exposed to the cold. There's something else in you, quite different, that likes its toes warming at the fireplace. There's something else totally different up here, would like to see the show. And consequently, you have several beings inside you fighting. And some people may actually find themselves sitting there, fretting by the hour about whether they should go or not. Now, obviously, the thing to do to cure that condition is have one will about it, and say, I'm not going, or I am going, and do either one or the other, and then refuse to regret it. Committal and refusal to regret is the key to that kind of indecision.
What is the position of a man who has both his north and south pole? Powerful, very strong.
Powerful? Mm. Well, you know, there's a very old saying, the whip passes momently from hand to hand. See, we must remember that. Because the energy in the body is changing all the time. Supposing you haven't had a meal for some time, and you've been thinking, actually the blood is high in the body. So you think, oh yes, I'm a reformed character now, you see, and then feeling very pleased, you say, well, I think I'll have something to eat. So then you drop through that hole in your face a lot of matter, which the belly works on and breaks down into energy, and while it's doing it, you begin to feel drowsy, don't you? You can't think so clearly, and you think, am I really reformed or not? You see, the blood is now flowing down to the south pole. And after a time, food is very closely related to sex. Perhaps after a time, that reformation made up there when the energy was up there cannot be supported while the energy is down here. So then something occurs which that one has forbidden, simply because the energy is floating up and down the spine at different levels. Now, sometimes a man may be educated to the point of believing, like a, say, a Puritan was, still is in certain fields. You may be told, you belong to a good family, a family who never go out with girls, don't smoke, drink, swear, back horses, dogs, or wear their hair long, or something like that. And then, that is a concept in the north centre of your being. And it starts stealing energy from the food and storing it up and getting bigger and bigger. But meanwhile, through the eyes and other modes, stimulation is reminding you, supposing we're talking about a man, that women exist. So some of the energy is going down here. Now then arises a double polarity. There's energy down there and a concept up here. That the energy down there is wrong. But the energy down there says, I'm right. Now then begins a fight. And this one starts sending impulses up the spine. This sends impulses down the spine to control it, and there occurs across the diaphragm there, generally across the diaphragm, a strain which begins to affect the breathing, and it can very rapidly affect the digestion, and if persisted in, it can result in what we would call a split personality. That is to say that alternately, one wins and then the other wins. This man down here, the John Thomas McGinty, down below, he wins a round and he feels terrible, you see, and then because he's tired, he wins the next round and feels pleased. But the moment his strength's back, he wins the next round. So as long as there's this alternation, the man feels terrible and ununified and ashamed of himself. And unless he can understand the meaning of this diagram, he cannot conquer that sort of thing, because he doesn't know that there is an actual movement of energy down and up. Now, if you understand it and you want to think clearly, you will not first stuff your stomach with potatoes, because potatoes contain atropine, belladonna, which makes you feel terribly dopey and you can't think with it. So you wouldn't fill your stomach full of potatoes and then start reading Euclid, because you would promptly start nodding. And if you really want to do some work, you cut down on the kind of foods that make you dopey, and you introduce into your diet more and more of the foods that make thought easy. And the foods that make thought easy are fruits, salads, and so on. So you'll find that if you eat a heavy cooked meal, you can't think so well. But if you eat salads and fruits, you'll find you can think better than you could before. This is the basis of all the restrictions on diet in all the major religions. That the fruits are very light, refined, high-frequency chemicals that aid thought. Whereas if you take the heavier substances and heavily cook them, it takes a lot of digestion and drags the blood down in the body, and thus empowers the South Centre to dictate the policy that the body must follow, in spite of the education of the North Centre. The whole thing is a question of knowing what to do and then persuading yourself to do it. And the more you can see the truth of this integration diagram and the necessity for it, the more you will incline to do it without fighting yourself so much. If you become absolutely certain that it is essential to do this work, then you won't argue with yourself so much. But if you say to yourself, I'm not sure that it should be done, and most people seem to get on without doing it, then you will not try. And one of the best methods of reminding yourself that it has to be done, ultimately, is to tell yourself that people are arranged above each other in the relation passive-active. That active is passive to another one above him who is active. The active one always gives the orders to the passive one. So it means either you can give orders to your own organism, which means self-control, or if you cannot, orders will be given to it by other beings outside it. And this is the elementary opposition. Either you will rule yourself, or you will be ruled by some other beings who have ruled themselves. And when you think about the seriousness of that, then you will find it easier to consider working on yourself. We know for a fact that propaganda can sweep millions of people into a war, and yet that propaganda is in the hands of a few men. But if we look in to the history of those few men, we find that those few men belong to a few families who have specialized in self-control. We know that the patrician Romans, for instance, they used to have at the initiation of their boys at puberty, when they conferred upon them the toga meninis, they would have a big celebration for the servants, and they would give all the wine desired and all the food to the servants, so that the servants became disgustingly drunk and vomited all over the place. And then they would take their son, 14 years old, and take him to the party when it was well going, and say, now look at those men. They have no self-control, and we have. They are the servants, we are not. They have no control, we have control. Now, if you learn to control yourself, you join us. If you won't learn to control yourself, you must belong to them. Make your choice. The child then said, I prefer to go daddy's way, or I don't. If he said, I don't, they didn't give him the toga virilis. If he said, I like daddy's way best, then they gave him the toga virilis. He had decided to control him. So the toga itself means the crucifixion of the gullet. So if we remember that T-O is like circle with a cross in it, and ga is the same as garbled gullet. So toga means the ability to crucify your own gullet. In other words, to curb your own appetite. Because either you will be down there, dictated to because you are drunk and incapable, or you are able to control yourself and nobody can dictate to you.
What happened with the case of men like Tolstoy, who had made a battle and a problem out of such behaviour?
Well, of course, he hadn't been fortunate enough, because of the condition of Russian society at that time, to have the proper initiation that he should have had. If he had have had, then the problem would not have been so terrible for him. But Russian society had degenerated and lost a lot of the practice and these fundamental principles that had been retained elsewhere.
But talking about Tolstoy and the Russian zone for people, could that be the reason that they lost their power? Because they lost their control?
Oh yes, well of course that was so. Because actually they started indulging their bellies when they thought they had secured their position. And you cannot stay on the top unless you deserve to stay on the top. You can't fight your way to the top and then become a belly man and roll about the ground. You see, if we consider the stories told about the wild parties before 1917, therefore it is time for the Voltaire. Remember, Voltaire was a Marquis. He was a trained man. He said, right, start a revolution. Thank you. It is time, because everybody at the top is now stopping. And there can't be a revolution until someone at the top becomes too soft.
That's like an automatic phase, that's automatic.
It's automatic, that is self-moving, that is logically necessary, but if the government can't govern, it will be observant. And it can't govern and indulge itself at the same time.
I'm not sure on this point, but I have an idea that the people that overthrew the Russian aristocracy had been in Russia for a long time, and then they suddenly appeared there.
The actual revolution movement appeared in the Russian universities. It did not appear in the people. There were certain cultural influences in the universities that did it.
I don't think Lenin had lived in Russia for a long, long time just prior to him.
Oh, no. Well, it isn't only a question of Lenin and Marx and Engels and those people. They only provided an ideology. You see, this ideological structure of Marx and Engels was borrowed by the revolutionaries because it suited their ends. If there had been another ideology equally valid, they would have borrowed that. The fact was that this was foreseen by certain people, some inside Russia and some outside, that there must be a change. And the change would come either from the people, which can only mean absolute destruction, or from the intelligentsia, who have not allowed themselves to become sloppy. Therefore it started in the universities.
So that once again the men that appeared in the forefront were not really the people?
Oh no, they're not the real people. They never are. The people that get their names in the paper as leaders are merely the facade for the others who don't. It's a question of elementary logic. If you ask yourself, is the position of a leader of men in times of revolution dangerous, you would say yes. Well, then, if I wish to lead something, should I show myself on a public thoroughfare, standing up in a car, waving my hand, so that a man can throw a bomb at me, or should I get a friend to do it? And the whole point about it is to find a willing substitute. Hitler and Mussolini are small fry compared with the men who put them in. You find a man with the gifts of the gab and with some ambition, and you say, we have the kind of job that you would like to do. He then does it. After the time, he tries to overthrow the people who put him in, and he is then overthrown. That's vaulting ambition or leaping itself. It's the same with the trade union movement in England. You get people starting from the bottom, say like Bevan, shouting violently in the early stages of his career, and finishing up like a calm, grey-haired, old kind man with a conservative mark all over him. Suddenly. That's the natural evolution, so well known to the Conservative Party that they actually have the nerve to print it and say that every trade union leader is a Conservative, whether he admits it or not. Although he doesn't start that way, because, as Lord Acton said, power corrupts. He has an ambition, he'd like an upper middle class house, like a baby palace, if he could get it. If he gets it, he's satisfied to keep the status quo.
And through that ambition, he can be led or pushed.
Of course, you can't lead a man without an ambition. You find a man with no ambition, you find somebody who cannot be led. Now, ambition, ambi means double, doesn't it? If a man has ambition, you can split him. Because he's already double. A man to have ambition must offer something to somebody who hasn't got something already, and he must go to those people who have it and take it off them, mustn't he? So it's two men, really, isn't it? A man who's promising to reward those who support him, and a man who goes to the people who have it and tries to persuade it to give them to the men below. Now, the men that have it say at a certain point, well, we won't give you 10, we'll give you 3.5, and one for yourself on the quiet. Will you persuade the men to accept that in arbitration? And he says, well, I'll try, and he goes back, and if he can manage it, he does. Because he's a middleman, then, isn't he? The trade union leader is a middleman. And if there is an incorruptible man in politics, we don't know how he got there. Because you have to have an ambition to move into it. A man may start with a useful idea he'd like to do good without defining what good is. I have a friend that's entered politics in an attempt to do good in that way. Now, he represents the typical evolution of one. First, he has no power. Then he tries to do good. But underneath, he really wants to do good to be valued. When he does a bit of good, he gets a little bit of value. Then he feels a little bit strong. He wants to do more good for the feeling of the strength he's acquired. Then he finds he's up against other men who've already done themselves good in the past and now start building a wall between themselves and him and saying, if you represent the people over there that have not, well then, we will not give you what you want. But if you represent us without admitting it, we will give you what you want, but not what they want. And this is the position of the middleman in all fields, isn't it? In the case of the Jews in Poland, we know their history. In Poland, there were two classes of people, the peasants and the aristocrats. There was no middle class. And then refugee Jews from Spain and other parts of Europe went into Poland, and because they were not peasants, they couldn't work, they were not aristocrats, but they had got the jewels and the money with them. So they set up as moneylenders. And they lent the money to the aristocrats, not to the peasants. The peasants needed it. The aristocrats wanted it. But if nobody giving it to peasants, they'll only eat it and drink it. But if the aristocrats will give interest on it. That was the theory. Now the aristocrats borrowed and borrowed and borrowed until finally the Jews said, now what about a little bit of recognition, a little knighthood, a little tap on the head with a stick? And then they started anti-Jewish propaganda. They said to the people, you are being impoverished and trod upon by the invading Jews. And so at one blow they removed the people to whom they owed money and the social problem of what to do with the middle class that shouldn't be there. They actually wrote them together and burned them in the hundreds. The peasants did the job and they were triggered off by the aristocrats who had borrowed the money. It's one of the European black spots. But if those people hadn't have gone in there with that intent in the first place, it couldn't have happened to them. Things happen to people because people move in specific ways. If you don't like what happens to you, move in another way.
I get the idea all the time of souls for mammon.
Well, mammon means count
the spirit, isn't it?
Mammon means count the material side of it, doesn't it? Mun means count, evaluate. Mum is material. Mammon means count the material side. You have mammon on one side and freedom on the other. You cannot serve the free and the bound at the same time. Mammon is bound and God, Spirit, is free. So you cannot be free if you are selling yourself at the same time.
You're really going in whichever direction the cat is held in front of you.
Of course. Which is all the same thing as being in the donkey position.
I remember you saying once that the sage is not a free man yet.
The sage? The sage is self-bound, isn't he? He binds himself to the universal truth to escape the temporal lie. Doesn't he? Supposing I understand that a certain law exists called the law of inertia. And I know that in the time world it means, psychologically, that the mind of a man, once being made up, he cannot unmake it himself. A stimulus from outside will have to unmake it for him, otherwise he will remain in eternal bondage. This is the meaning of religious education, tradition and so on. A stimulus from outside to release a man from the established erroneous ideas that time has given him. Christ calls them the dead, the men of the inertic mind. They are dead men, they are in the groove, they can't get out. You have to hit them. So that you have to put yourself under something, either rubbish or the truth. If you put yourself under the temporal, phenomenal presentation, you are a slave to the time process. If you put yourself under universal truth, well then you are cooperating with the universal truth. You obey it, but you do it deliberately, because it's better. St. Paul says we are of the law, not under it. Of the law means we affirm that it's a universal law, because we know that it's affirming us. We agree with it. We are not under it. That is to say, the law of inertia is such that although it exists, we can utilize it. And that's a person in the temporal process cannot.